Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My son Milad, he was only 5 years old. He was a cute boy, a cool boy, funny boy.
Today, we spend the hour looking at the devastating reality for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation. We'll speak to a Palestinian father whose 5-year-old son Milad died in a fiery bus crash on a school field trip. Abed Salama's quest to find out what happened to his boy was immediately hindered because he was a Palestinian living on the wrong side of the Israeli separation wall. Abed will join us along with the journalist Nathan Thrall, author of the new book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy.
The aim of the book is to immerse people viscerally in the lives of Palestinians living on the other side of this wall and to make them feel and understand what that life is like. And one of the things that struck me more than anything as I was working on it was how much pain there is just beneath the surface in every single Palestinian family.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, two Republican leaders emerged Wednesday as leading contenders to replace Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House, a day after his ouster by far-right Republicans brought Congress to a standstill. One contender is Ohio Congressmember Jim Jordan, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, leader of the far-right House Freedom Caucus. Former wrestlers at Ohio State University have accused Jordan of failing to intervene as a team doctor sexually abused young men in the 1990s. He was one of the wrestling coaches. Also announcing a run for the Speaker's gavel Wednesday was Republican Majority Leader Steve Scalise of Louisiana. Reporter Stephanie Grace told the New York Times Congressmember Scalise once described himself to her as like David Duke without the baggage, referring to the former Ku Klux Klansman and white supremacist. President Biden called on Republicans to quickly elect a new speaker and to change what he called the poisonous atmosphere in Washington. Biden said he's worried congressional gridlock threatens to derail White House efforts to win new funding for USAID to Ukraine, though Biden said his administration has enough funds in reserve to continue sending arms shipments for now and suggested he has a path around Congress if it fails to approve more funding.
We can support Ukraine in the next tranche that we need, and there is another means by which we may be able to find funding for that, but I'm not going to get into that now.
On Wednesday, the Biden administration said it supplied Ukraine with thousands of assault rifles and more than 1 million rounds of ammunition seized in the Persian Gulf by the U.S. Navy. The Justice Department says the arms were being sent by Iran's Revolutionary Guard to Houthi rebels in Yemen in violation of a U.N. arms embargo. Meanwhile, peace activists are demanding lawmakers push for a diplomatic solution to the war in Ukraine instead of sending more weapons. On Wednesday, Capitol Police arrested 11 members of the anti-war group Code Pink as they occupied the office of Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders. Code Pink's Medea Benjamin read a statement Sanders delivered in February of 2022 calling for peace talks between Russia and Ukraine.
So let's sit down, let's negotiate, and let's come up with a diplomatic solution. That is the good Bernie.
Yeah.
That's the Bernie we want. Not the other Bernie who is okaying billions and billions of dollars in weapons and says you can't talk to Putin. And we have one word answer to Bernie when he says you can't talk to Putin, because he said that to us. We say, try. Right?
Try.
We want to see what the result of Biden talking to Putin is, right?
In climate news, new data show global average surface temperatures last month shattered the previous record for September, rising to a staggering 1.8 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That's well above the Paris Climate Agreement's limit of 1.5 degrees of warming and half a degree warmer than the previous record. This follows the hottest August and hottest July ever recorded. In northeastern India, at least 14 people are dead, over 100 missing after extreme rainfall in the state of Sikkim caused a dam to partially collapse, washing away roads and bridges and flooding an army base. In Brazil, scientists are blaming an unprecedented heat wave for the deaths of over 150 endangered pink river dolphins in a lake in Brazil's Amazonas state, where water temperatures reached 102 degrees Fahrenheit. Brazilian authorities say the Amazon rainforest is facing a severe drought that could affect 500,000 people by the end of the year. This comes as a new study in the journal Science Advances finds monsoon rains that sustain the Amazon rainforest are nearing a critical destabilization point and could soon drop up by 30%, leading to a dieback of the forest. The Biden administration's waived 26 environmental laws to speed the construction of the U.S.-Mexico border wall in Texas. The waivers circumvent the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, among others. It's the first time President Biden's used his authority under the Real ID Act to waive environmental laws. In a statement, the Center for Biological Diversity said, quote, every acre of habitat left in the Rio Grande Valley is irreplaceable. We can't afford to lose more of it to a useless medieval wall that won't do a thing to stop immigration or smuggling. President Biden's cynical decision to destroy a wildlife refuge and seal the beautiful Rio Grande behind a grotesque border wall must be stopped, they said. Previously, President Biden had said he would not build another foot of border wall. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians and wounded dozens of others during late-night raids. Israel's killed over 200 Palestinians this year, including at least 27 children. Elsewhere in the West Bank, armed Israeli settlers violently attacked a Palestinian-American family farm in the town of Deir Dibon near Ramallah Sunday night. The attackers set the property on fire, spray-painted the word revenge on a door, and destroyed the family's olive grove. Meanwhile, emergency medical workers in Gaza have reported a spike in ankle injuries among protesters. Israeli forces, including snipers, appear to be deliberately shooting at Palestinians' legs and ankles, wounds that are extremely difficult to treat and can lead to amputations. Human rights groups also say the brutal tactic is unlawful. Recent protests in Gaza have condemned Israeli raids in the West Bank, the storming of East Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa, a compound by Jewish settlers, and the blockade of the Gaza Strip. After headlines, we'll spend the rest of the hour looking at the devastating reality for Palestinians living under Israeli rule. In Egypt, opponents of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi say they've faced violence and other obstacles preventing them from registering their candidates for December's election. Under Egyptian law, candidates have until October 14th to secure at least 25,000 signatures from supporters. But dozens have been arrested attempting to submit signatures, while others have faced attacks by well-organized mobs of pro-government activists. This is Rania El-Sheikh, who says her delegation was attacked by thugs as they attempted to register signatures.
When we felt that the fight was brewing, we tried to move aside. While we tried, I was pulled by my hair and they started beating my colleague on his shoulder.
Ahmed Tantawi, an outspoken critic of President al-Sisi and the most prominent figure hoping to run against him, temporarily suspended his campaign last week after dozens of his supporters were arrested by police. Meanwhile, researchers at Citizen Lab and Google's threat analysis group found Tantawi's personal smartphone was infected with predator spyware and that Egyptian authorities were likely behind the hacking attempts. Mohamed Anwar al-Sadat, head of Egypt's Reform and Development Party, called on Sisi's government to reverse course to provide free and fair elections.
If the election is not held in the way that the entire world expects it to be, I say that this will lead to really bad results for the reputation and credibility of this regime, and even for its future.
Back in the United States, damning new information has emerged in the bribery indictment against New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez, his wife Nadine, and two of their three co-defendants. Nadine Menendez hit and killed a pedestrian in 2018 car crash in Bogota, New Jersey. But not only did she not suffer any legal repercussions, she received a new car following the lethal crash. According to police reports and dash cam video, Nadine Menendez claimed the 49-year-old victim jumped onto her windshield. She was not held by police or tested for drugs or alcohol after the crash. Video of police questioning her immediately after the crash shows an officer treating her deferentially.
Our job is to investigate everything that happens. That's what we're trying to do. Obviously, the more information...
Do anything wrong?
No.
Look,
I understand. I understand. It does expedite our investigation when people can help us out. Because if we can clear you from any wrongdoing, I want to get you home and comfortable and not here anymore. You get what I'm saying? Nothing against you.
The fatal crash took place before Nadine was married to Senator Menendez, but while the two were dating. She received a brand new Mercedes-Benz 4 months after the crash. According to court documents in the bribery indictment, the $60,000 car was gifted to Nadine by New Jersey businessmen Wael Hanna and Jose Uribe, two co-defendants in the bribery case. Prosecutors accused Senator Menendez of offering to put pressure on the New Jersey Attorney General's office to go easy on an associate of Uribe. According to the indictment, while Hanna, an Egyptian-American citizen, quote, worked to introduce Egyptian intelligence and military officials to Menendez for the purpose of establishing and solidifying a corrupt agreement, unquote. Senator Ben Cardin, who has replaced Menendez as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, just blocked $235 million in U.S. military funding to Egypt. A judge has set a trial date of May 6 in the bribery case against the Menendez couple, Hanna Uribe, and another businessman, Fred Dives. And President Biden's approved another $9 billion in student loan relief, affecting some 125,000 borrowers. More than half the amount will go to 53,000 people who've been working in public service for at least a decade. The rest will be split to provide relief to those enrolled in income-driven repayment plans and borrowers with disabilities. The latest move to lessen the burden of student debts comes months after the Supreme Court blocked Biden's plan to cancel up to $20,000 in student debt for tens of millions of people. Despite the right-wing court's ruling, the Biden administration's been able to pass $127 billion in debt relief for over 3.5 million borrowers. Debt activists are calling on Biden to cancel all remaining student debt. Federal loan payments resumed October 1st after a pause of more than 3 years during the pandemic. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Coming up, a day in the life of Abed Salama. Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. Stay with us. Umri, performed by Kulthum. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we spend the hour looking at the devastating reality for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation. The acclaimed journalist Nathan Thrall has just published a new book titled A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. Abed Salama is a Palestinian father who lives in Anata, a segregated Palestinian neighborhood on the outskirts of Jerusalem that's surrounded on three sides by the 26-foot-high Israeli separation wall. Many refer to it as the apartheid wall. In February of 2012, tragedy struck Abed's family. His 5-year-old son, Milad, died in a fiery bus crash during a school field trip to a theme park. Abed's quest to find out what happened to his son was immediately hindered because he was a Palestinian living on the wrong side of the separation wall. He held the wrong ID to pass Israeli military checkpoints and didn't have the right papers to enter the city of Jerusalem. Nathan Thrall, who lives in Jerusalem, first wrote about this tragedy in a remarkable 2021 essay for the New York Review of Books. On Wednesday, Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I spoke to Nathan Thrall and Abed Salama. Nathan began by discussing why he wrote about Abed Salama and the tragedy his family faced.
You know, this event is every parent's worst nightmare and an awful, awful tragedy under any circumstances. But it was made so much worse by the unique circumstances in which it took place, by the fact that the victims were Palestinian, that it took place on a road that is controlled by Israel, patrolled by Israeli police, but on the other side of a separation wall, a 26-foot-high concrete wall that separates and segregates tens of thousands of Palestinians from Jerusalem, born and raised in Jerusalem, residents of the same city I live in, but who are cut off from the city that they were born and raised in, specifically because of their ethnic identity. And these people live in the same city as me, but they live an entirely different existence. And the parents of the kids on this bus live in a walled ghetto, encircled on three sides by this separation wall, and a fourth side by a different wall that runs in the middle of a segregated road, famously called the Apartheid Road. And inside that walled ghetto, which sits just underneath the manicured grounds of Israel's most prestigious university, you can look down on it from Hebrew University down onto this ghetto with trash being burned in the street because the municipal services are non-existent there, with no sidewalks, roads in total disrepair. When I drive into this area to visit Abed and other families there, I have to pull off to the side just to let a bus pass on the main artery for tens of thousands of people. I'm rolling down my window and pulling in my side mirror to let regular bus pass me. And this is just the everyday reality of all of these people. They receive virtually no services from the city that they pay taxes to. And they are forced to prove that they have maintained their residency in the right part of this enclave, or else Israel will strip them of their blue ID, which allows them to travel in and out of Jerusalem, and they live in terror of having this blue ID taken away from them. Some of the parents in this area have green IDs, some have blue, they're all from the same families, and the outcome for them on this day was very different. There were real consequences to having a different colored permit on that day. Abed was one of the parents who wasn't able to go and look for his kid in Jerusalem when he was told that that's where his boy was, and other parents did. There were bystanders because the emergency services came so very late. All of the kids had been evacuated by just ordinary people in private cars before the first Israeli emergency service provider arrived. And those people themselves drove off in all kinds of different directions, depending on what kind of what color ID they had and whether they could pass through a checkpoint. And there was total chaos. Parents didn't know where their own children were. And so this awful event allowed me, in telling the story, to describe the entire elaborate system of segregation and subjugation and apartheid in which all of these people live.
Abed, I hate to take you back to that day, but it is such an important story for people to understand. Introduce us to your little boy, Milad, and talk about what happened that day.
Hi, everyone. My son, Milad, he was only 5 years old. He was a cute boy, a cool boy, funny boy, loved the life. So the day before the accident, in the night, he said, "Father, I want to buy some sweets and chocolates for my trip. It is the first trip with the school." So I took him to a grocery around supermarket, and he buy his things and the favorite chocolate, the Kinder Kids and juice. And then we go back home. He was very excited to join his friends in the journey, in the trip. So we got to sleep earlier. Next day, I was planning to go to Jericho for a business with my cousin. The weather in the morning was very stormy. So I got up. I didn't see Milad when his mother prepared him and put him in the bus in the car to the school. So after an hour, my cousin came and we took his car in our way to Jericho. Then I received a phone call from my nephew. He asked me if Milad in the bus, Nurul Huda school, in the bus to the trip. I said, I told him, yes, he's there. He said, "Uncle, there's an accident in Jaba Road. The bus is crashed." So we changed our way from Jericho to Jaba Road in that stormy weather. When we arrived before the accident, or the place of the accident, before there is a military Israeli military checkpoint, they closed the street before. They didn't allow us to pass with the car. So I jumped out of the car and start running to the place of the accident. In my way up, you know, it's raining and stormy weather, military jeep passed on me. So I wanted to stop them to take me with them. They didn't take me. So I continue my way to the place of the accident, running uphill. So when I received there, there was nothing, only I saw the bus crashed on the side and a big trailer on the other side of the street. So I start asking about what happened to the kids, where are the kids? Everyone, there was many, many people around. There was only one fire truck. I didn't see any ambulances at that time. I saw only civilian police officer from the PA. So the main thing at that time, I was wanted to know what happened to the kids. Where are they? And start searching and asking, where are they? Where is the kids? So somebody told me that they took them to some of them took to Adessa in Karim Hospital in East Jerusalem. Others told me they took. Them to military space, Israeli military space in around. And others told me maybe they took them to the hospital in Ramallah. So I asked, I met two guys from Jenin, I asked them to take me to Ramallah Hospital. They are strangers, I didn't know them. They allowed to take me. Then they took me to the hospital. When I arrived there, it was very crowded. Many, many people there. The parents of the victims and police and ambulances, media. It was very, very crowded. And I started to search in the building of the hospital. So I asked the doctor who is in the reception about I'm looking for my son Milad. He was in the accident. When she looked at the list, she didn't find his name. She told me his name is not in the list of the in this bus. So I started to search in the hospital rooms. I didn't find him. I met other parents who are from our neighborhood. I know him. They already find their kids. They was injured, and I asked them if they say if they saw my son or their sons know anything about Milad. Everybody was busy in his own case. So everybody said, no, we didn't find him. So here I started to search, where to search. I searched again in the same hospital. I didn't find him. Then somebody told me maybe they took him to Hadassah in Kerem Hospital in East Jerusalem. I didn't have a permit to pass the checkpoints to Jerusalem. They didn't allow to us to pass because I have a green ID, Palestinian ID. So I called a cousin of mine who have blue ID and asked him to search in Hadassah in Karim. After maybe 1 hour, 2 hours, he called me back. He said, I searched all the hospital there. Milad is not there. So after 6 or 7 hours, everyone from the parents find his son injured or safe, except me and six families. So a doctor from there came to me and he said, you didn't find your son yet, and we have to take some blood from you to make a DNA test. I asked him why. He said, we have six bodies for small children and the body of the teacher. Burned. So he asked me also to call my wife and my son Adam to come to the hospital to take blood from them for the test, DNA test. I called them. It took more than an hour to receive to the hospital. So they took up a blood from us. My wife was shocked. I was crying. At the same time, I was looking at her face and my Adam's face. They was shocked. She didn't cry.